It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there's a steady drumbeat of gun violence here in the United States. It can be easy to feel like we're getting a little numb to the problem. A psychologist tells us how we respond to tragedies individually and collectively. First, Russia is attacking Ukrainian port cities and grain depots after backing out of an international deal that let food continue flowing through the Black Sea. Russia and Ukraine are both top global food producers. The instability could be affecting grain prices across the planet. We have the USDA's chief economist with us for a look at the global food supply and how the war in Ukraine is affecting food insecurity in some countries and agricultural markets here in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to know about the global food supply chain? Are you worried about the impact of the Ukrainian war on food prices in the United States, around the world? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Seth Meyer is chief economist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Seth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I was looking at charts. When you look at wheat, corn, barley, Ukraine, one of the top five exporters in the world prior to the war. Russia, of course, up there on all of those two. How big a worry with the outbreak of this war was there on the for the global food supply?
So I think at the original current, so let's go back to February 23rd of 2022. So we're about 18 months out. We were already in a pretty tight market situation. And so you added a big shock both on crop production and the inputs for crop production like fertilizer, at a time when the market was already tight. That's why you saw a tremendous amount of volatility right when the war broke out.
How much did this deal with Russia saying, okay, yes, you're at war, but you're going to let Ukrainian food keep flowing through Ukrainian ports out into the world, how much did that mitigate the concerns?
So I think at the time when the Black Sea Grain Initiative started, it gave a little bit of breathing room so for the market to adjust and for us to get some of the grain that was trapped in Ukraine out. So at the time, you know, so we started shipping through the three ports on the Black Sea. Overland shipping routes were established. Routes through the Danube port were established. So it came at a time that says, hey, let's get this grain moving. And then the world market has adjusted a bit since that point. So I think when it started, it was a key element to starting to cool some of the volatility that we saw. And clearly we saw prices come down as the initiative took effect and that grain moved.
Russia now says we're out of the deal. Apparent Russia blamed for attacks anyway on grain supplies in Ukraine and grain ports. Are we seeing an impact there on global grain prices since that's happened just over the last week?
Yeah, so I think we got to separate it out into a couple things. So, you know, when we were talking maybe a week or 10 days ago about the ending of the Black Sea, act on, say, a Ukrainian farmer has really been a tremendous push and an adjustment in production within Ukraine, as you can imagine, because it's expensive to transport grain out, inputs are expensive, et cetera. And so the grain deal itself might have had a impact overall commodity prices, but we haven't just kind of ended the shipping of grain out of the ports from the Black Sea. We've seen an elevation of hostilities. And I think that is what the market is doing.
I'm going to jump in. Seth, we're having some connection problems. We'll have our people talk to you here for a moment. And while they do that, I'll remind you, we're talking to Seth Meyer, chief economist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, looking at the global food supply, the supply chain, and the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine on food costs globally and in particular countries that rely on grain coming out of Ukraine. You could join in, by the way, if you have a question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. And if this is affecting your livelihood in some way, if you your job as a farmer or in food processing or exporting is involved in this global food supply and you're feeling, for better or worse, the impact of what's going on in Ukraine. Love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Okay, Seth, I think we've got you back. And you were talking a little bit about what we've seen since Russia backed out of this deal.
Okay, so as I was saying, I think the Black Sea Grain Initiative in isolation, the market had largely adjusted. The Russians had already started to slow down inspections. But I think we saw an intensification of the conflict when the Russians actually hit those three ports in Odessa the last several nights. And then last night, they hit the ports right on the border with Romania on the Danube River. So I think the market is now worried about escalation, worried about general conflict in the Black Sea, and maybe even drawing in concerns about Russian supplies of wheat. Russia's got two big wheat crops back to back, and it has been supplying it to the world.
As I understand it, one place that relies particularly on Ukrainian wheat is East Africa. It's often a source of imports in East African countries, and food relief agencies rely on it. How big an impact does it have in places that might particularly rely on this Ukrainian wheat supply?
So I think you have both the direct customers, some of whom, and some of these are indirect supplies as well, too. You know, you think about wheat being supplied to Turkey, leaves Turkey as flour, and goes to some of the most vulnerable countries in the world, Yemen, Angola, places like this. So one has to kind of add the extra step there. But clearly, the Ukrainian wheat merely being added to the world market also helps reduce and stabilize prices. So while the Russians may say, hey, a lot of this grain is going to European countries as well, its supply on the world market helps stabilize prices.
Now, I wonder how this system works here, how easy it is to transfer. So say if I'm a country that's relying on a particular source, say Ukraine, for my wheat, and that's stopped now by hostilities in the Black Sea. How quickly can I say, okay, well, that's fine, I'm going to import from another supplier versus all that other supply is already locked in on contracts and things like that, and it takes quite a while, in fact, to substitute?
So I think that is not necessarily the issue logistically. Mm-hmm. You may have other relationship issues, though, in terms of this country will provide me credit or has worked with me or this supplier has. I think those can sometimes be challenges. I think world wheat markets are supplied to a reasonable extent, and people can maybe have to pay a bit more, and certainly they have to pay a bit more, perhaps, to get it from a different origin. But wheat is available. I think the other concern for some of these countries has been that wheat's priced in dollars, and the dollar's been very, very strong on top of all of this. So while we may have seen wheat prices come down from their peak at the Russian invasion, in their domestic currencies, they may not have come down nearly as much.
I want to bring things here to the United States now. And here in the Midwest, of course, we grow a lot of the products we're talking about, the wheats, the corns, the barleys, and more. Have we seen U.S. exports affected by what's going on in Ukraine?
So I think we've certainly seen global prices affected by what's going on in Ukraine. And I think early on, we might have gotten some benefit from limited supplies out of, say, maybe, you know, the world was, if folks looking for corn might have said, I can't get it out of Ukraine, or I better secure some U.S. supplies. So to the extent that we're taking out a small amount, a modest amount of Ukrainian production, it's not such a large effect. Now, if you tell me it gets bigger, the overland route doesn't work, the Russians are also drawn into this, and those supplies aren't put into the world market, I think we start seeing more global price effects. I think our export volumes have been limited. The increase in export volumes have been limited by the direct effect.
Talking to Seth Meyer, chief economist of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, looking at global food prices and how Russia backing out of a deal for shipping Ukrainian grain could affect hunger, food prices around the globe. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question either specifically about the impact of this war in Ukraine on global food supply, on global food prices, or more generally about how this interconnected system works, how food is making it from one place to another, what affects prices? And if this is part of your business here in Wisconsin or one of our neighbors, love to hear from you. By the way, are you being affected by drought if you're growing these crops? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the global cost of food and how the war in Ukraine is affecting the food supply, hunger in parts of the world, food prices around the world. We have USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer on with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the impact of the Russian invasion on the global food supply, wider issues of food export and import around the world, how it affects our agricultural economy here in Wisconsin, and how about drought? If you are a farmer, is this affecting you right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Seth, another factor in food prices I'm guessing you have your eye on right now. I'm looking at the U.S. drought map, some, including here in Wisconsin, some severe drought going on in places, and I'm seeing a lot of overlap with places that grow grains. How big a concern is that this year?
So I think it's a great question that you raised. You asked me, hey, have U.S. farmers benefited from impacts of Ukrainian supplies being constrained? Well, when it comes to wheat, we've had a limited ability to export because we've had drought over a large part of our winter wheat production area, right? So we've had a limited ability to respond, and we continue to see drought kind of move a little bit to the east and cover areas of our winter wheat production, our corn area, our soybean area. Now, this is providing some support to our commodity prices, but I think when it comes to U.S. food prices, you got to remember that about 16 cents of the food dollar comes before the farm gate. 84 cents a dollar on the food dollar comes after the farm gate. So yeah, things like wheat prices have an impact, but they're quite modest when it comes to retail food prices. That's for many commodities. But I think we've seen many supply shocks. Last spring, we had issues with avian influenza, which hit egg layer flocks, and we saw big runs in egg prices. Those directly transmit into grocery store prices. So I think when one looks at food price inflation, there are things which make their way quickly into the grocery store shelves and things which are a little bit farther back and where a lot of value add is created.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Stevens Point. David, hi.
Hi. Hey, I wonder if your guest could comment on participation in the large American agribusiness organizations, places like Cargill, they, as far as I read, are not participating in the boycott of Russia, and I wonder what difference their participation could make.
David, thanks for the call. Seth, with certain products, I know the world is trying to avoid Russian goods. How about agriculture, and how about the larger companies and their connections with Russian agriculture?
All right, so this is it's a great question because the U.S. and other like-minded folks have explicitly exempted Russian food and fertilizer products from sanctions in an effort to kind of keep some stability in those products and not to put spikes into world food prices. Now, interestingly, the Russians have actually begun to constrain their own domestic market, forcing some of these international companies out. They've consolidated control actually themselves up to the point where they the load out into the ships. So in some cases, it's the opposite in that the Russians have consolidated control on those wheat on that wheat moving out of the country.
David, thanks a lot for that call. Great question at 800-642-1234. Seth, is that having an effect on the global food suppliers, or just a matter of Russians are making the money off of it as opposed to maybe a foreign investor in Russia?
So I think it's a little bit of both, right? So first, you're right in terms of the Russians want to be able to control the wheat coming out of that country. And it's 22% of global trade. I think one of the elements that makes this a negative for global markets, an additional one, is that there's no transparency there. As soon as the war started, the Russians stopped reporting what wheat they're sending and where they're sending it. So we've got a supplier who is consolidating control over their wheat market and simultaneously not telling us what they're doing with it. So I do think that there's an element to that that adds to uncertainty and adds to market volatility even more.
We're talking to Seth Meyer, chief economist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, looking at global food prices, how they've been affected, among other things, by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There was this deal for quite a while, about a year now, where Russia allowed Ukrainian grain sales to proceed through their Black Sea ports. Russia says we're out of that deal, and now we're seeing attacks attributed to Russia anyway on Ukrainian ports involved in grain export and grain supplies themselves. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on this, maybe your experiences if you are in this line of work, if you export foodstuffs yourself, 800-642-1234. As always, of course, you can email ideas@wpr.org. Seth, I wanted to talk about the supply chain issue you mentioned a few moments ago. Of course, during and after COVID, we saw these supply shocks to lots and lots of manufactured goods. Was there a similar story with the global food and food processing supply chain?
So I think your audience can remember back to, say, hamburger, right? We definitely had supply chain shocks within the United States, within our food sector, where we were having COVID outbreaks in meat processing facilities. This limited the number of animals that could be put through a slaughter facility. That really hurt the value of those animals for farmers. So farmers saw the value of their animals decline precipitously. Amount of output you for consumers who were at the grocery store. I think we saw all kinds loaded into containers and containers be sent back to Asia and all the supply chains being very clogged for the return of those container shipments, resulting in some folks perhaps missing their prime marketing season. I think we've largely worked through a lot of those supply chain issues, but we do see other events, and I mentioned things like HPAI, who have introduced a lot of volatility and uncertainty into the market as well, too. When I think about things at a global level, I think it is now not an issue of availability as much as it is affordability and supply. Some countries simply, the price is very high.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Seth Meyer, chief economist for the USDA. Join us for a look at global food supplies, the impact of the Russian attack on Ukraine, and more. As always, you can follow up with your emails, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
The connection between a grandmother and her granddaughter is special, especially when it's bound by braids. Writer Araceli Esparza tells us more about it in the story Braided Life or Vida de Trenzas.
Everyone, everywhere wears their hair differently, but not me. My braids, I wear them every day because I like it that way. I wear a braid like mi mama, and she wears her braid like her mama, my grandmother. Braids are familia, but some days with all of its twists and turns, I wish to lose or cut it short. Monday, lunes. Mama, why do we wear braids? Quetzali asks. Braids are who we are, mija. I wear braids. Abuelita wears braids. Braids are like family. We are family every day. I don't want to wear my braids anymore. I want to be like everyone else with short or curly hair and be me. Tuesday, martes. At school, I see wavy hair, corn-rolled hair, twisted hair, and even colored hair. I want to snap my trenzas away, but when I touch them, they remind me what Mama said, and I walk on. Wednesday, miércoles. In front of a mirror, I comb my hair up, Maybe like this. I tease it sideways, or like this, to make new hair and a new me. Thursday, jueves. Abuelita, when I go to the tienda, there's short, spiky, and long hair, but my trenzas are woven. At the dress shop, I see round, soft, fluffy hair, but my braids are pulled tight. At the fix-it store, I see slick and shiny hair, but my braids hang down. You're right, Quetzali. Everyone wears their hair differently, says Abuelita. Friday, viernes. Our hair connects us to where we work, who we are, and where we come from, Abuelita tells me on the way to the park. I run, but my braids make me slow to chase or too big to go under, and after a while, my braids are like two matted fighting cats. Saturday, sábado. Abuelita, the kids at school yanked on my trenzas, and sometimes my braids get in the way of having fun. Gently, she sits me up on the chair and begins to part my hair. I understand, Quetzali. Sometimes when people see trenzas, they wish to have one, and because they don't have one, they feel that teasing is the only way. Abuelita, if I cut my hair, will I still be familia? Ay, Quetzali, familia is familia, always. Remember, if you do cut your hair, it will grow back. Sunday, domingo. Sitting in the salon with pinned up hair, ready for my haircut, I see me without my long, strong hair, and I see me, lonely and plain. With a twirl, I stop her scissor hands, and I make my braids like propellers, and with a whoosh, I'm in the air. Zoom, zoom, between backyards and from playgrounds and rooftops, I see all these people with shiny, brown, braided hair like me, looking royal and proud. My braids, I wear them every day because I like it that way. Y mientras dejo tu trenza, imagino cuando crezcas.
Araceli Esparza is a writer based in Madison and host of the podcast Midwest Mujeres.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, people who rely on Medicaid are now starting to need to reapply for it annually after a pandemic-related hiatus ended. We'll find out how this change is already affecting people here in Wisconsin and what recipients need to know about keeping their coverage if they still need it. Now, news of five people being shot in a mass shooting anywhere in the U.S. used to be the kind of story that might stop you in your tracks, make you reflect on the state of gun violence in the country. But this past weekend saw four different shootings with five victims each. And if you didn't live in Tampa, Memphis, Chicago, or Houston, you might not have even heard they happened. According to the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive, the U.S. reached its 400th mass shooting of the year on Saturday. That's more mass shootings than were recorded in any year before 2018. We're on pace to set a new record by the end of 2023. The rising frequency of these tragedies can make them feel less and less shocking. We can even start to feel more numb to their impact. We've talked in the past about the politics of these issues, the public health angle on gun violence. Now we're getting a psychological perspective on this idea of becoming numb to tragic events. Our next guest researches this kind of emotional numbing and how we respond to difficult societal problems. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you started feeling more desensitized to news of mass shootings? Do some stories of tragedy still affect you more than others? How do you balance your emotional response with protecting your own mental health? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Slovic is a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon, where he studies human judgment, decision-making, and the psychology of risk. He's also the founder and president of Decision Research, an international research group that looks at how we make complex and risky decisions. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be with you today.
Can you tell us a little bit about this idea of psychological or emotional numbness when it comes to tragedy? I think we have a concept that it can happen, but what does it look like in practice?
Well, we rely on our feelings to guide us in making all kinds of judgments and decisions through our day, and to as kind of a compass that guides our behavior as we navigate the day's issues. And these
Hi,
feelings.
Hi, Central Time.
Oops, sorry, we crossed a wire there. Paul, please go on.
Okay, so we trust our feelings to guide us in and influence our behavior. We also have science. We've learned how to create scientific ways of gathering data and analyzing it to help us make decisions about risky actions. But most of the time, we trust our feelings. And one of the things that we have learned through research, but it's also very evident when you look outside the laboratory at what's going on in the world, is that often we respond very strongly when an individual or a small number of people are at risk. But then when, as the numbers get larger, we sort of lose the feeling. The data, the information becomes, if there are numbers, we don't see the individuals beneath the surface of the numbers, and we don't react as strongly to that. We have a kind of a concise summary of this rather shocking way our brains process feelings of risk, and where we say, the more who die, the less we care. That's a form of psychic numbing, a very strong reaction to the individual, but less and less reaction as more individuals become at risk.
And literally the difference between hearing about one tragedy and two people, if I understand a research you've, I think, worked on yourself, there's a drop off just going from one person to two people in a tragedy.
Remarkably, that surprised us. Not that we don't react to two, we do, but the feeling of concern one has when you see one person in danger, it's very strong. Going from no one to one is a huge difference. Then if there are two, you don't feel twice as concerned. You may feel more, but it's not the concern than with one, but not twice. Mm-hmm. Think, for example, about if I told you that there were five people in danger from some issue, and you think about that, and you'll be concerned. And I said, "Oh, wait a minute, I was wrong. There's six people. I bet that you won't feel any different thinking about six than about five, because that's how quickly our feelings kind of reach a ceiling, which is so high at one that it doesn't have a lot of room to grow, and so it kind of flattens out. We become desensitized." But one other thing, it's even worse than this. Sometimes when the numbers are really large, it's not that we just don't react very differently when there's additions. It's that we actually react less. We say that our feelings kind of fade or collapse. Like if you hear about thousands or millions of people who are harmed or in danger from natural disasters or violence or whatever, they just become numbers. And you don't have any feelings at all towards them, unless you stop and think carefully about the reality of what underlies those numbers.
I assume the answer to this isn't, we're just terrible people who don't care about large scale tragedies. What is going on in our brains that enables us to, I guess, understand one tragedy, but not really grasp the scale of a larger tragedy?
Well, I think that's a very good question. Basically, it was very adaptive when we lived in the Stone Age in caves, when we had to mostly react to things that were immediate, dangers in front of us, like a single individual who might be threatening us, or an animal or something like that, something in our immediate experience. So we're very sensitive to these kind of threats and react very strongly. Well, that same part of our brain that reacted that way is still present in our brains today, although we have now evolved the ability to think more abstractly, more analytically, to use evidence and science as in addition to our immediate intuitive feelings. The problem is that it's easier to rely on our feelings. It usually works to get us through our day, especially if our feelings have been honed and tuned by experience. We can trust them. And so it helps. It's very adaptive until it's not. And one of the ways that it's not is when when there are more people in danger, when the numbers get big, then we can't comprehend or integrate the large numbers here. Our feelings have kind of a limit. They don't do arithmetic. Our feelings don't do arithmetic. They don't add. They don't multiply very well. We have to use the part of our brain that does the math and realize that if I tell you that there are six people at risk, that's one more important life than if there were five people. It's not that we can't do it. It's that the brain is lazy and it's easier to rely on our feelings, and our feelings don't do arithmetic.
We're talking to psychology professor Paul Slovic at the University of Oregon, looking at the idea of becoming numb to large-scale tragedies, including ongoing concerns about gun violence, incidents of mass and individual gun violence in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your experience as you see this in the news again and again over the years. How does that make you feel? Does it make you want to turn away? Understandable if so. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. First off, if you have a conscience, you can't turn away. You won't look away because you're still accountable. Number two, one is a tragedy, two or more is a statistic. I went to Wauwatosa West in the 90s. I graduated in 1998. When I was in middle school in eighth grade, a gentleman by the name of Leonard McDowell, and I use gentleman very loosely here, walked into Wauwatosa West and gunned down the associate principal, Dale Brightlow, in the hallway in the middle of school. And it's, you know, it was my friend's dad. He was a kind, generous man, and everybody has these people in their lives. One is far too many, because I know too many other people I graduated with, went to school with, where we have met and come across, ran across paths across the rest of our lives. And this has continued to affect us. And it's deep. I mean, it's deep effect. And it just... it doesn't go away. The security, anything can happen at any time. We live in a random world. But we can stop some of this. We can curtail some of it, and we have to. It is an absolute imperative in my point of view.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that that difficult experience. And Paul, a lot there we could talk about from Marcus. First of all, the impact of a shooting, I think sometimes, again, we're statistics-driven, the number of people dead, maybe the number of people wounded. Marcus reminds us, it affects a lot more people.
Yes, and certainly there's, you can see the trauma that Marcus experienced there, and that's very real, and that's what happens if you experience this, or you know people you care about or love who have experienced it. Then this is deeply disturbing, and it doesn't leave you. I mean, you're not relying on statistics; you're relying on, you know, the emotionality of what this means. And so that's and one has to think about this. For example, even if you're not a direct victim, like now because of so many shootings, you know, some people are saying, well, the way to deal with this is to to arm teachers, to put armed guards in the schools, and to continually drill the children as to how to protect themselves against an active shooting in the schools. Well, think about this. Most of these schools, there fortunately has not been a shooter, but we're already having them practice responding as though there were a shooter in the schools. Think about that sort of a secondhand trauma, which will likely color their view of the world and the people around them and the safety. Children are very vulnerable. They have a lot of fears, and we're drilling this into them, you know, that you can't trust people around you because they might come to your school and shoot you. Then this is, even when it doesn't happen, it's traumatic. So it's, I mean, agree with you that it's a problem. It needs to be managed, and we have managed some of these major problems in the past through sort of what Nicholas Kristof calls public health type measures. Like, for example, we brought down the harms from smoking through education and regulation. We've regulated traffic safety so that there's a lot fewer traffic accidents and deaths than there used to be through education, through design of the environment, through regulation. So I think we need to take that approach. I don't think we'll be able to get rid of guns, or nor should we desire to get rid of all guns. We need to manage these in a sensible way.
Thanks again for the call, Marcus. We're talking to University of Oregon psychology professor Paul Slovic about the idea of psychic numbing, how we get desensitized over time to repeated tragedies like gun violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself feeling numb to news of mass shootings? Does the frequency of the tragedies make you feel less hopeful that we can prevent them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Paul Slovic, psychology professor at the University of Oregon, who researches decision-making and risk. He's with us today to talk about how our brains respond to tragedies, including mass shootings, and how we can build up emotional and psychological numbness over time. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. We heard from Lisa. Lisa says, when one person is in danger, we feel like there's something we can do about it. When thousands of people are in danger, we feel like there's nothing we can do. And Paul, I think that's an important part of the story and your research, the idea of, you know, can we make a difference in the face of larger scale problems?
Absolutely. That's a very important observation. And it deals with the issue of efficacy. It's one thing to be aware of the problem. And if you feel that you can't do anything about it, well, then it makes sense to make yourself numb, to turn away from it and pay, because why torture yourself worrying and fretting about things you can't control? So you turn your attention to things that maybe you can do something about. So the issue of efficacy, again, efficacy is another aspect of the way our feelings can deceive us, just like numbing is a way that our feelings deceive us about the magnitude of a problem. We our brains let information in that conveys feelings that may not be relevant. So let me back up here. We try to do something about a problem because first there's a need, and second because we feel effective doing it. And if our attention is called to the fact that we can only do a little bit on the problem, or we can't fix the problem, and there's a lot that we can't fix, that creates bad feelings, which our brain lets in to mingle with the good feelings about doing something useful, and it devalues the good feelings, and it doesn't feel as good to do something helpful because of the feelings, that bad feelings of what you can't do. So we get demotivated from doing what we can do because of what we can't do, which may be irrelevant. And so basically we have to appreciate that even if we can't fix a problem entirely, or we're only a small, you know, in a sense, you know, a small drop in a large bucket, that drop may be very important. And we've got research that shows that even when people can really save a life, if they're shown other lives they can't save, then they don't do the help that they can do, and that's not rational. So we have to be aware of the fact that our minds deceive us, and not let that happen. And one way that we can actually be more effective, even if the problem is big, is by joining forces with organizations that are dedicated to the problem and can magnify our effect. You know, support these organizations with financially, support them by working for them or with them, by turning out for events that they put on, and supporting their political activity that is aimed at helping in this problem. So you can magnify your efforts and your efficacy by joining in with others.
Let's go back to our callers. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hi.
Good afternoon. Ironically, I was just composing a Facebook post about how the sheer volume of charges coming up against Donald Trump makes him less weighty. I think the volume decreases the seriousness. And a few years ago, a photographer got a picture of a father and a daughter drowned trying to reach I believe it was Italy. And suddenly people were talking about, oh, this is a crisis. Same thing. The photographer managed to get a picture of a DHS agent forcibly removing a child from their mothers.
Randy, I gotcha. The power of photography, Paul, I think you've also looked at.
Absolutely. Again, we're talking about feelings. So even though numbers are not good at stimulating our feelings, images, photos, testimony of people, these have powerful impacts. Very dramatic evidence of this that we studied a few years ago involved the war in Syria that started in 2011 when people started protesting against the government of Syria. The government started fought back by rather than listening to the protesters, killing the protesters, and that escalated. So 4 years later, there had been 250,000 Syrians who died in these battles in Syria, and millions fled as refugees. Well, we looked on Google for evidence of concern about this. You know, people searching under Syria refugees, there wasn't any, and that changed overnight with the photograph that went worldwide of the little boy on the beach who was trying to flee with his family from boat capsized, and the boy was washed up. A very shocking picture. And overnight, people started searching for Syria and refugees. But even more important, they started donating money to aid agencies. Overnight, for example, in Sweden, the Swedish Red Cross, which had taken in 150,000 Syrian refugees in 2015, there and set up a fund to care for them. That fund increased from about $8,000 a day to $430,000 overnight when that photograph came up. And it shows that how statistics of 250,000 deaths didn't make a difference, but that photo woke people up. And another interesting thing is that it lasted, but it didn't last forever. A month later, everything had kind of filtered down to where it was before. So when you see a dramatic photo like this, it does make it, wakes you up, engages you emotionally, makes you want to act, and it provides a window of opportunity when you are ready to do something. But that window of opportunity doesn't last forever. And the same thing with a school shooting. After the school shooting, people are engaged and they want to do all kinds of things. And then over time, it may fade. So you've got to act quickly when the emotion is still raw and motivating.
Randy, thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Yeah, I think that this is a good discussion because these things can numb you or they can really make you angry, like I am about these school shootings, because they are mostly preventable. And if we didn't have cowards kowtowing to the gun industry, children would be safe and wouldn't have to go through this trauma.
Martha, thanks for the call. Paul, reacting with anger and I think calls to action as opposed to a numbing in the face of gun violence or other tragedies. And in our last minute, your thoughts on what we do with our reactions?
Well, amen. I mean, anger is a powerful emotion, and I think we need to be angry about the way guns are used abusively in our society and take so many cause so much trauma and harm, different from anywhere else in the world, I think, in terms of the amount of violence like this. And it is not necessary. It can be greatly reduced, and we need to be angry enough to work politically to make it happen.
Martha, thanks for that call. And Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Paul Slovic, professor of psychology at the University of Oregon, where he studies human judgment, decision-making, and the psychology of risk. He's also founder and president of Decision Research. That's an international research group that looks at how we make complex and risky decisions. He's with us today to talk about the idea of psychic numbing and how tragedies like gun violence start to feel less severe as they become more common. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, take a tour of land trusts around Wisconsin and find out what they mean for conservation and public land access to nature. You can get the conversation started right now. Are you involved in a land trust, maybe either on your own property or as a volunteer or part of a conservation group in your part of the state? Or do you have questions about what those are, how they work, and or how to get involved in them? Join in with your questions. You can email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Remember, you can stream this, that, and all conversations on the Ideas Network online at WPR.org. Or you can always download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your phone or tablet. On Food Friday last week, we talked about non-alcoholic cocktails and other zero-proof beverages. We've got a couple recipes from our guest up at WPR.org/Food Friday. We heard from some of you during the show, and we've gotten more comments on email and on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jim emailed, "My favorite NA drink is tonic with a splash of Rose's Lime. Too bitter to drink quickly, doesn't need to be fancy. Nazdrovia, guys." Jim, Nazdrovia to you, too. Thank you. Leah says, "I think NA beers have come a long way from just O'Doul's. I love Athletic Beer and Heineken Zero. My favorite NA drink right now is half NA beer and half lemonade." So I guess a shandy. Dave on Facebook has a beer recommendation. He writes, "Sprecher Root Beer is awesome. I'm a big fan of mixing some fresh-squeezed citrus, cocktail cherries, and their juice, a few drops of bitters, lots of ice, top it off with cold water. This weekend, I bought a zero-proof bourbon. Haven't tried it yet. I'll report back on my first cocktail I make with it." Keep your ideas coming on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.